this next Valentine's Day, listener, stay tuned for
Love and Sports with Maddie McLeister.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in southern New Hampshire, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke, who appears to be in his studio on the longest hallway in North America. How are you, Ken?
That is correct. I am not in Studio 598. I am in the office today. In and out of the office these days as it's the summer.
And how is summer in Lethbridge?
Well, actually, this summer has been very different. It's not been crazy hot all the time. We've had rain. There's actually mosquitoes this year because there has been enough rain to create standing water, which
blessing.
By this time last year, the issue wasn't standing water. It was whether or not we would have any water by the end of the summer.
Uh-huh.
So it's been reassuring that way that, I don't think the aquifers and reservoirs are getting drawn down as heavily at this time of year as they have been in years past.
Good, good. Perhaps to foreshadow a discussion we're going to have later on in the show, how's your garden doing?
It's doing quite well. And this year haven't had to water it as much. We had a bumper crop of cherries this year. And so I was, over the last week, processed and froze about 3 pounds of cherries, but also made cherry scones and made a cherry crumble. So,
That's great. That sounds delicious. You're back from the field.
Back from the field, as are you.
Going back out in early August.
Oh, okay. And what's the next destination?
Coastal stuff in Maine again for a week.
Very nice, very nice. And the listener can't see this, but unlike in a previous episode, Gabe and I did manage to coordinate our fun guy shirts today, and so
we did. We did. We thought that was important, just to set the tone for this podcast.
Exactly. To set the tone for season four, which is this is the season premiere of season four, and the listener.
So it is.
It is. And the listener won't know this, but Gabe, you've just had a major career milestone. And the listeners, I'd like them to go check the show description as they're listening to the podcast. And you'll notice that there's been an upgrade. And so today, rather than this podcast being hosted by Gabe Reinick, associate professor, we're talking about professor and talking with Professor Gabe Reinick, no modifier. Congratulations.
The one I like, Ken, thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate that. But the way I prefer to think about it as I spent a year studying at the Catholic University of America where the faculty rank for professor was just called ordinary professor. And I've always thought that has an incredible ring to it.
Yeah.
I think it's derived from German. I think German academic ranks might sometimes be ordinary professor, but I've been enjoying that. But thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate it. It's nice to know that I don't need to keep up a CV anymore. And in fact, you might be seeing a lot more of me in fun guy shirts.
I think it's well-deserved. And so does UNB have a university professor ranking above professor? Are you at the
No.
Apex?
I think this is it.
Yeah. Oh, that's very exciting.
And don't suggest it because, as I've mentioned, as the dean said to me in a meeting, that he's like, and you don't even have to publish anymore. And then paused and he said, obviously, we would prefer that you do.
Well, even if he's not going to publish, folks, we'll keep him here for your listening pleasure for years to come.
Yeah, the listener can't see this, but it's going to take a lot longer in this new glass to get to a half finished bottle of Courvoisier. Is all I'm saying. It's the bottle is bigger.
But
in all seriousness, Ken, thank you for your support in that direction. A lot of that work was completed with you, so thanks very much.
Yep, it's been a pleasure, and at some point, maybe in the show's history, we're a long ways away from me getting that designation, but someday.
Well, that'll be exciting, Ken. I think you must be up for associate pretty soon, right?
Next fall. So next fall, I put in my application for tenure, and here, tenure and promotion should be packaged together in a in a normal progression. So
you'd apply next year. So in 2027, the listener should be prepared to start sending you bottles of scotch.
Exactly. So at the tail end of, I guess it would be the tail end of season 5.
And listener, if you buy Ken a Bowmore 12 now, by then it'll be a Bowmore 14.
There you go.
It's an excellent way to prepare for the celebration.
Exactly. And yeah. Belveni, if you're listening, you know.
Yes, absolutely. And so, Ken, but enough about us. Let's talk about the podcast. The listener may notice that this podcast is still called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
It is.
And that's interesting, isn't it? And the topic we're going to talk about today, in fact, it really should just be the North American Archaeology Podcast. Of course, that name wouldn't be any better, really. It would just encompass more of what we talk about.
Exactly. North American and global impact, I guess, or global context in terms of the research that we're talking about today with Maddie McLeister.
Due to the time travel, this will be the second time that, the listener doesn't know this, but obviously we actually scooped the New York Times on both of our last two interviews. It's just, due to our production delays, we don't get it out quite as quickly.
Exactly. And this will be a real time travel one because we recorded the interview 2 weeks ago and the episode will come out in about 4 weeks, I think.
I think that's right, yes. Yeah. But Ken, before we get to what we're going to talk about today, it seems like, as we mentioned, that it would make sense to rename this podcast, don't you think?
It would, Gabe. And so we're in the fourth season, right? So
yes,
that's right. In hockey terms, we're in OT. In football and basketball terms, we're in the last quarter. In baseball terms, we just need a snack.
We still have 5 innings
and
to
another
go.
Beer. But four actually means a lot to a lot of different groups of people. In some Southeast Asian cultures, for example, it's synonymous, quite literally a homophone for death. But among North American indigenous cultures, Hindus, and in the Judeo-Christian and Islamic tradition, it can mean balance, harmony, completeness, and have deep symbolism from the seasons to the elements to the cardinal directions.
Oh, interesting.
So according to the stars, we're either going to die or potentially have the best season ever. That's essentially, this season 4. But looking ahead is what we're doing today, and not just because we're recording this well in advance of when this episode will air. But
I'm looking ahead because you just said there's decent odds we're going to die.
But because I think our listeners deserve a bit of a forecast ahead. And so, Gabe, you've got a birthday coming up, right?
Did you say a forecast? Or not a three-cast or a five-cast, but a forecast?
It is a forecast. Yes. And so, Gabe, you've got a birthday coming up, right?
I do, yes.
Yeah, and we're both...
But the time the listener listens to this, though, I won't.
Exactly.
I will, in the sense that we all always have birthdays coming up.
and we're both approaching 40, and I wonder if we could use some clarity. Maybe we could draw on the four Purusharthas. Dharma, which is duty, Artha, which is wealth, Kama, which is pleasure, and Moksha, for liberation, for inspiration this season on the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
And as they say in the part of the world where I am right now, Dharma.
Exactly. And so this fortnight to launch our fourth season, we're inviting the listener to rename this podcast, and in return... we're going to try to provide our listeners with some cosmic order. So today, we're offering a package built around fortunes and futures, and it begins by mailing you...
not three chins, and definitely not five chins.
Exactly.
Fortunes.
A custom NB ArcPod sounding bell.
As I near 40, I actually get closer and closer to having four chins every day.
We've partnered with Dharma Shop to bring you the finest in tonal healing. Yes, built with the copper sourced in the Kathmandu Valley, these bowls are crafted by 4th and 5th generation Tibetan monks, and you'll have your choice of premium singing bowl, whether you choose to go holistic healing with the Ayurvedic bowl, or go big with the Master Healer bowl. Of course, your chakras won't be in alignment if that noise isn't reverberating off of a custom-engraved NB ArcPod logo, complete with a mallet carved in the shape of your hosts. And nothing sends those bowls ringing like the bearded visage of yours truly.
It's hammer time.
Next, we're setting up your wealth journey by arranging for a custom tarot card reading with a descendant of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Yes, we're resurrecting the magical secret order just for you, listener, so that you can understand whether your career is destined for riches or poor. And Gabe, because it's nearly your birthday, I've gone ahead and consulted the new Order of the Golden Dawn, the great master itself, reading.tarotly.ai, to see if what your forecast is looking like.
Are you saying Golden Dawn as in the sun rising or Golden Dawn as in The Godfather?
D-A-W-N. The Order of the Golden Dawn. And so Gabe, I've consulted the AI tarot reading, and I hate to say it, but despite your recent career successes, you've drawn the Nine of Swords, which opens up some foreboding warnings. It says, worry steals clarity. The Nine of Swords represents mental overwhelm and inner torment. Picture yourself lying awake, long past midnight, looping through every unresolved email, every what if, every perceived failure that hasn't yet occurred. The room is dark, but your mind is lit like a stadium, every doubt screaming into the void. This card marks a challenging theme. Anxiety driven by over-identification with imagined outcomes. Now, the listener...
So wait, this is different than the 30... So 37 is going to be much like 36 is the message I'm getting here.
And so the listener might not know this, but that is a horrifyingly accurate for any academic, and especially so my co-host, Gabe Reinick. And so let's just set aside this one and move right on to pleasure. Yes, for your
thank you, comma alignment,
we're going to keep this PG, listener, but you're in for a treat because pleasure can come in any package. And knowing that many of you are...
Also, just to clarify, you're in for a treat, and I'm in for a treat, but those might be separate, listener.
Exactly.
I don't want Ken making any promises for me here.
Many of you are from our homeland on the East Coast, and we pulled together a package of pure pleasure that involves your favorite activities. So your day is going to start out with a five-star breakfast from the Red Lantern in Fredericton, New Brunswick. And after downing a couple of Caesars and getting a shoulder rub from Daryl, you're going to grab a tube for a sunny cruise down the Nashwauk River. And we're going all out here, listener, and all day long, you're going to be ferried around the fine landscapes of the GFA in a 2025 Ford F-150 Lightning, pairing luxury with environmental sustainability. And of course, It's not a beautiful, pleasurable day if you don't wrap up with a campfire in somebody's backyard or at a cottage on the water. And handcrafted super donaires imported straight from King of Donair in Halifax will be paired with that. And if pleasure wasn't enough, our final chakra today is moksha, or liberation. And while liberation has taken on somewhat of a negative connotation in recent months and years, We're going to right that ship, or perhaps left that ship if you'd like, and we're going to help you liberate your mind, spirit, and voice. That's right, listener. The last part of this prize is a custom session with your co-hosts on starting your own podcast, where you can grab a mic and a soapbox and share your views, speaking into the void for anyone to listen, liberating those thoughts, lamentations, and all the negative energies that might be trapped inside. When it comes to esoterica, a niche in the podcast world, you're in good hands. And listener, all of this is available to you if you can rename the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
Wow, Ken, that is a prize that is, I feel like that prize has more gravitas than some of our prizes I've had in the past. Like that prize, not only are you winning, you're assuming great obligation, but with it, the great potential for karmic success.
In the words of Stan Lee, with great power comes great responsibility, Gabe.
That's so true. And so, Ken, if the listener wanted to assume that power and that responsibility, where would they send the new name for this podcast?
They would be sending that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And you can also find us on Instagram at new_brunswick_archaeology and archaeology spelled the same way.
That is right, and we should say also that we thank our sponsors for making sure that we're talking to you today, and that all of those pieces of infrastructure are still working, and our sponsor today is the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada.
That is correct, and so we are back this season, not with a grant specifically for the podcast, but with funding that includes the podcast as an important part of knowledge mobilization.
Exactly. And Shirk, we'd like you to know that if you do ever decide to fund us, we will rename this mailbag the Shirk Memorial Mailbag. But since we haven't done that yet, Ken, what is in the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast mailbag?
What is in the mailbag, indeed? And now, Gabe, because we haven't done this for a while, I actually didn't have the mailbag queued up here. And
oh, yeah. I like that the listener... Sometimes I wonder if the listener really knows that we actually do just read... That you just read these... As they come in.
Completely blind. And the listener will also realize, yeah, I read these completely blind, commit to sending you mail. But the problem is I don't open up the mail until the next time we do a podcast. It can be months or weeks in between. And I have an awful memory to start with.
Which is why we're excited to announce that our next live podcast is actually going to be from the UPS store in downtown.
Exactly. So we do have some, some mail in here. And so we have an email from Lila, and the title is Monitor Stand Alternative. Okay. Says, what? Hi, Gabe and Ken. I hope you're both doing well. I know you have a running joke on the show about how your book, 3000 BP to Contact, makes for a good monitor stand because it's so thick. I thought I would share that this quality also makes for a great bookend, which I just realized recently, photo attached.
Lovely.
So I'm going to actually share my screen with you, Gabe, so please you can
do.
See this.
Please
and,
do.
So here's Lila's new book stand. and
that's great.
Adorned not just with a Far Northeast, but with a New Brunswick archaeology bibliography.
That's fantastic.
Which is very exciting. And so it makes a good, great bookend, which I recently realized. It also happens to look quite nice alongside your other books, as you can see in the photo, which look even nicer when they've been won from giveaways. Best.
Well, thank you so much, Lila.
Taylor. Okay. This is from Taylor, not Lila.
Okay.
The email is from Lila.
Do you remember that Taylor had written in that she had she wrote me to say that she had accidentally written us from her burner account and that we were going to get an email that wasn't going to make any sense? I believe that that this may be an email account that Taylor uses exclusively to get giveaways.
Well, Taylor, that's excellent. Thank you for the email.
Yes. Thank you so much, Taylor.
The bookshelf looks great. It's got Gabe's book on there. It's got the bibliography. It's got the Far Northeast, and hopefully, we can fill that out as we continue on.
I hope so. Yes. Thank you very much, Taylor.
Okay,
the listener we'll have just heard from Taylor in the last episode, who was on the Field School.
Two episodes ago, actually.
Two episodes ago. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah.
So,
yes, I forgot about our emergency pod with Chris Dorr.
Exactly, yes. This one is called Dispatches, and it's from Michael. Ken and Gabe, not that this hasn't been apparent in numerous earlier episodes, but as I listened to Dispatches, I was struck by the way in which both of you shine without a shred of self-promotion as exemplary teachers and scholars. Well, thank you, Michael. It's very kind.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate that.
In this time of rabid and deeply troubling changes within academia, more dire, I think, south of your national border, but nevertheless global in scope.
Ken, do you want me to pause for a minute so that you can finish printing that off for the file that you have on your desk labeled Associate Professor Application?
Yeah, exactly. That seems to go into the PAR folder, Michael.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Your fieldwork descriptions and conversations with students gave me hopefulness about the continuation of the noble academic enterprise. I wanted to acknowledge that and thank you for being such models of commitment to the mission and the integrity of your discipline and to the success and well-being of your students. Well, this is just even getting nicer as we go.
Very generous. Thank you.
I've retired from an academic career in a very different discipline, spent about half as a faculty member and half in administrative roles. The qualities that become apparent in your teaching and research through the podcast are ones I only saw in the very best colleagues during my career. Thank you for your commitment to values that are still worth holding dear, even as they are challenged by fierce political, economic, and cultural forces. I continue to enjoy your podcast and very much appreciate the window that Dispatches provided into your roles as both scholars and teachers. Bon courage, carry on, Michael from Vermont. Thank you.
Oh, what Michael. A lovely email. Thank you, Michael.
That was a lovely email, and we really appreciate that.
Quite nice.
And Michael, the thanks goes back to you, like just for continuing to listen
Absolutely.
To the show, being engaging and sending emails and just kind of being a great audience.
Yes.
So that's really appreciated.
Thank you so much, Michael.
And because we I guess haven't checked the mailbag for we have a third email, Gabe.
A third email, Ken.
Third email.
Wait, but not a fourth. So does that mean that the chakras are aligned or not aligned?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, it would have been great if we had a fourth one, eh?
Mm-hmm.
So this one is titled Historic Artifact Clarification, and this is from Nadine. It says, Hi, I've been listening to the podcast ever since I met Ken at the CCRA meeting in Toronto earlier this year. Oh, that's great. Thank you, Nadine.
Okay. I was having an interest. I was wondering, what did Mrs. Dr. Reinick write in about involving an historic artifact?
Yes. Gabe, where are you?
Yeah, exactly.
Nadine wrote this as Gabe was in the field for an extended period of time. And this is mostly calling Gabe back. This is like
she'd seen the bin with the empty Courvoisier fits.
So not to distract from Nadine's email, but Gabe and I have both read the field notes of a longstanding and a very well-respected archaeologist, David Sanger, from the Maritimes. And there's this great one from, I believe it's his 1968 field season, where
yes.
Sanger receives a letter when he's collecting his mail. And his only entry in the journal that day is he received a letter from home and had to return. something came from his wife to beckon him back to Maine, basically. And it's not clear what it was, but I don't know if we'll ever know. So
somebody should really convert that those late 60s field notes into an audiobook.
Yeah,
it's almost Joycean in its modernism. I would say
it is. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so Nadine...
But sorry, I interrupted Nadine, sorry.
Yeah, Nadine goes on. I originally tuned in to hear the recap of the meeting, but I've been hooked ever since and decided to go all the way back to the beginning and listen in order. Oh, thank you. Thank you. I only recently
that's
got...
It's great that she started at episode two.
Yes. Yeah, hopefully.
I assume that's what she meant.
Yes. And Yvine is a historical archaeologist, too, to give some context to this. I only recently got to the episode Begun the Colonial Wars Have, where Ken mentioned finding a bottle of Hamlin's wizard oil on a survey in northern BC, but referred to it as a case bottle. Unfortunately, I have a little Hakuna errata to submit. We've never had a combo Hakuna errata and email.
No, that's
right now, that's
very new.
Did you see the thumbs down come up on your screen?
I did, and I don't really understand why. I assume that's Emmanuel. He just felt it.
That was strange.
Huh.
Anyway, yeah. It must know that when we say Hakuna errata, we're talking about we did something wrong.
Yeah.
For the listener, a Zoom.
But that didn't happen that time.
A Zoom thumbs down. Bubble just appeared in front of Gabe's face. Emanating from your microphone, of all things.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Very ominous.
So Nadine goes on, I held off to see if anyone else would write in, but I haven't heard anything yet, although I still haven't caught up. No, nobody has caught this, Nadine. This is great, because this goes back to 2011 when I found this. I thought this is in a case bottle all the time.
But you might need to write to the province to annotate the report.
Yeah, maybe. Yep. But thought I'd offer some friendly guidance on historic artifacts. While I haven't seen the bottle you found, Ken, I can almost guarantee it wasn't a case bottle, but a patent medicine bottle. Okay, so I guess I didn't realize that they were considered two separate classes of artifact. Patent medicine bottles like Hamlin's wizard oil were mass-produced in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, often embossed with the product name and designed to be eye-catching on pharmacy shelves. They're usually rectangular or oval and very much tied to the era of colorful cures and bold claims. Case bottles, by contrast, are square or rectangular with flat panels and beveled corners designed to be tightly packed in wooden crates. They date from the 1600s into the early 1900s and most commonly held gin or other alcohols. Anyway, I've been really enjoying the podcast. Thanks for all the thoughtful discussions and laughs along the way. Looking forward to catching up to the newer episodes soon. Cheers, Nadine. Well, thank you very much, Nadine.
That's
a fantastic and very informative email. And maybe we should get Nadine on the show sometime to talk some
case and wizard oil.
Absolutely. Maybe give us some context there. I know Nadine's worked on a bunch of Parks Canada sites in Southern Ontario, and I actually have my former boss. The reason Nadine and I ended up chatting was because we share a colleague, Barb, who's my boss with Parks Canada, and she and Barb came up together in the Parks Canada world.
Oh, so. Very cool.
Yeah,
yeah, that would be great. I think I would have made the same mistake you did, Ken, because I think I would have seen the kind of flat, I assume you saw the kind of flat face of the bottle and called it a case bottle. I think that's what I would have done too.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually kind of assumed that those small rectangular bottles were all considered case bottles, even though they were medicine bottles. But I didn't realize that the patent medicine bottle is its own class of historical artifact. So that's very exciting.
That's very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Nadine. And so, Ken, if anyone wants to write in, where would they send those emails?
They're going to send those emails to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And as always, we also accept direct messages through our Instagram account @new_brunswick_archaeology, and archaeology spelled the same way.
Or taped to a bottle of Beaumont, Courvoisier, or the spirit of your choice. Or I mean, honestly, a rectangular bottle of gin.
Maybe a case bottle of gin.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so, Ken, speaking of things that are exciting, we have a very special show lined up with Maddie McLeister. And we're going to be talking about agriculture. And the listener might think to themselves that that's sort of interesting. They're talking about agriculture in a place where... Indigenous people didn't practice agriculture until after European contact. But in fact, we're going to be talking about a very similar place where Maddie and her colleagues found evidence for really widespread Indigenous agriculture before European contact. And that's the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Yeah,
where they found basically the largest farmer fields in North America.
Yeah, so not just agriculture, but intensive agriculture and some really rare evidence of what these fields, like these harrows, would have looked like, right? These harrowed fields, like a really, really interesting, fascinating study that includes some LIDAR imagery and description of a really significant find in a kind of unexpected place.
Absolutely. And one that's got real implications for potentially just how widespread agriculture could be all over North America. And this is because the place where Maddie and her colleagues found these raised fields is one of the few places in North America that, because it's not very hospitable to farming, hasn't been disturbed. And so we're able to pick up evidence for these features on LIDAR. And quite appropriately, this paper was published in Science, which is a major coup for any archaeologist, any academic at all. But Science is a big deal.
Yeah. And so the listener will notice that at the end of the interview, we don't have a hit pieces. And because this episode is an all hit piece segment where we're talking to Maddie about her research. And I'm realizing one thing that we didn't ask her, Gabe, is we forgot to ask her how many, what the corn heat units are of the Upper Peninsula in Michigan.
We did. And Ken, exactly four listeners have really tuned in to that reference to that paper in Northeast Anthropology, I believe, right?
Yeah, well, so what's funny is I'm in a geography department now, and corn heat units are actually like a thing, right, in geography.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they're like a measure of agricultural productivity, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great. Whenever I hear it, I think of perhaps the late Buster Poindexter appearing, just saying hot, hot, hot.
Hot is certainly what this paper is, and it's generated a lot of media and some really positive media for Maddie and her colleagues and collaborators, and really fascinating research. And for those of you who are non-academics in the audience, we've linked in the paper. It's widely available. It's open access on Science.
So it's open access if they use the link that we provide, is my understanding.
Yes. So use the link in the show notes for the open access version of it. And what's one of the things that we remark on and we discuss with Maddie is how exceptionally well the paper itself is written in a way that anybody who is a non-discipline expert would be able to read this paper and really get its implications and why it's so fascinating.
Yeah, I think as Ken pointed out when when he read the paper, he texted me and I think said something like, "Wow, you can understand why this paper got into Science."
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, you know, we try to communicate, you know, to a public through the podcast, but I don't think we do it super effectively in our writing. Right. And I think maybe, you know, to get in Science, I think you have to hit the important implications and have fascinating research, but also be able to communicate broadly to a wide audience.
Yep, absolutely. So we highly recommend the paper. And I guess, Ken, we should hand it over to our discussion with Maddie. But we're looking forward to seeing the listener in another fortnight when we'll do some more time travel. And until then, listeners, thanks for tuning in. And we're really looking forward to going on a journey this season with you. Ken, do we have a theme for this season?
I think that right now, I think our theme is complexity, is it not?
I think that's the theoretical theme.
Yeah, and much like our human-environmental interactions, we will dip in and out of that theme, and we'll do our best to have the red thread pulled through the whole thing.
Absolutely. It's a light leitmotif, I would say.
Exactly.
Yes, or a leitmotif light. Maybe it's like a beer.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And who knows? Maybe at some point we'll have a new name and we'll have a new sponsor and listener. We're happy to have you on that journey. So, thanks for being here for three seasons and looking forward to the fourth.
That's right. All right, Ken. All right, listener. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon, listener.
This episode, we're joined by Dr. Madeline McLeister. Dr. McLeister is an assistant professor of anthropology at Dartmouth College, where she's an environmental archaeologist whose research deals with human-environmental entanglements, especially relating to plants and past agricultural practices. She has a major collaborative field project with the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin and collaborates on additional projects in Michigan and in coastal Maine. She's the co-editor with Jessica Sana of a recent volume in the Archaeological Papers of the American Anthropological Association entitled Finding Fields: The Archaeology of Agriculture and Landscapes, and that's a theme we'll return to here momentarily. And her other publications have appeared in such journals as the Journal of Wetland Archaeology, American Antiquity, and Ethnobiology Letters. Today we're excited to talk about her recent article in the journal Science, Archaeological Evidence of Intensive Indigenous Farming in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, USA. And we're also going to take this opportunity to ask her about her course on the archaeology of indigenous games and sports. Welcome to the podcast, Maddie, and congratulations to you and your co-authors on the science paper.
Much.
Welcome, Maddie.
Yeah. Thanks for following up the New York Times podcast with the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast.
I didn't make the New York Times podcast. Not yet. Just an article in the science section.
Okay. Gotcha.
You were briefly trending, though, as the for like at least 45 seconds or something. You were one of the most downloaded or something. I saw your article on the, you know, on the right of the Times homepage.
That's right. And then also we were on NPR's homepage and we were on their featured stories that day. So there's a picture of graduate student and co-author on the paper, John Alperstein, along with Alex Jones and Elon Musk.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Real great for him.
So, assuming John has not been disappeared, we'll try to get him on too.
And
we should let the listener know that the part of the reason Maddie agreed to come on was that she knew that with our substantial audience, we could get her paper from 2,900 downloads up over 3,000, which is just a nice number to have there.
And the link is in the show notes, listener. So you better be clicking right now.
Well, and I mean, a lot of my research has been with the objective to eventually get on this podcast.
Thank you,
everything else has been practice. This is
yes
a Zoom call here. That's yes. To show that we're real pros.
Exactly. So Maddie, I wondered if you could begin by telling us what research question led you to look for indigenous agriculture in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, not a place often associated with farming.
This is a long form podcast, right? This is like
absolutely
it is, yeah.
Well, then I'll give you the long answer. So I had been working at a site since 2016 called Middle Grant Creek in Illinois. And that's a really cool site. What is there, the site's composed of this collection of storage pits. And so for your listeners who are not familiar with storage pits, what they are just big holes in the ground where people would store food. And these pits were, the site is located on former arsenal, World War II arsenal. And so everything else that would have been associated with this site is long gone. So houses, things like that, long gone. And this is very typical of Midwestern archaeology, that all we have left are these storage pits. The good news about it is that not only do we have the pits themselves to kind of think about different technologies employed to store food, but we also have the inhabitants, the Native American inhabitants that used them, refilled them with their garbage. So they would eat all the food and then they would throw their garbage into these pits. So we end up with lots of artifacts and can learn a lot about the past cultures. What's really interesting about the pits at Middle Grant Creek is that they are gigantic. The site dates to 1600. That time period is during one of the coldest periods of what's called the Little Ice Age. And the Little Ice Age runs from about 1350 to 1850, give or take.
That's AD dates, right?
Not yes, BP dates. Thank you. Yes, okay. AD 1350 yeah. to 1850. And so the site, it's very cold, and yet they have these massive storage pits. So they were obviously very successful at growing food during that time period. But the fields, wherever they were growing the food, is long gone. So it got me looking for, okay, well, what do we know about past indigenous agriculture in the Midwest? And that got me connected with Dr. David Overstreet, who has unfortunately passed away, who worked with the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin on their reservation, where they have a number of extant, so meaning existing, preserved archaeological agricultural fields. And that's because the Menominee are on ancestral territory, and so they have, since time immemorial, preserved their archaeological sites. So with that collaboration, we were doing a number of different kind of, one, using LIDAR to map the existing field sites on the reservation, along with studying plants that are, so to see, kind of see like the long-term impacts of these fields on current plant communities, testing the soils stemming from that collaboration. Dr. Overstreet and Dave Greeno, the tribal historic preservation officer, they knew about my interest in this kind of cold weather agriculture. They had been for,
which it must be said, sounds like a niche interest.
It was a niche interest. Now I think half of the U.S. knows about it.
Yes.
they knew about this, and there's a cluster of sites up in the UP that are ancestral Menominee, right at the border between Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And these are ancestral Menominee sites, and they had been trying to get this cluster of sites listed on the National Register of Historic Places. While going through that process, they realized the import of 60 islands, or kind of re-realized it. You know, they knew it wasn't an unknown site to archaeologists, but it kind of been lost in the shuffle over the years. And they really impressed upon us to go out there and do LIDAR. It's very hard to get from Hanover to New Hampshire to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's not a straight shot with airports. So we, you know, the Dartmouth contingent was really like dragging their heels to do it. But Dave Overstreet and Dave Greeno were really champions of it. And they, when we showed them, when the data came back and we showed it to them, they were like, see, we told you.
I'm imagining you explaining to John Alperstein that his next project is going to be on the Upper Peninsula, and him sort of getting there and being like in Casablanca where Rick says that he came there for the water, but he was misinformed. It's sort of that kind.
Well, John is the kind of Johnson. He goes to New Zealand once a year, so you're like, oh, it's, you know, it's going to take 8 hour plane travel, and he's like, oh, only 8 hours? That's not so bad.
Middle Grant Creek, you had these large storage pits, but you only get storage pits remaining there. You don't see these agricultural fields, and they're preserved on the reservation. Is that just the result of like modern farming and development and everything like that that's kind of destroyed all the other evidence, and it's that the storage pits are buried deep enough at Middle Grant Creek that they're still preserved? Is that sort of what we're seeing in those situations?
So when we think about these raised beds, the second you, they're pretty delicate features. And I think what I would argue that the research at 60 Islands and is in the article, what it shows is that these raised ridges, they're about a foot high and about, you know, let's see. I want to say
it's 30 centimeters, listener.
Oh, right. So I can actually, I'm trying to convert it in my head. So they're about 30 centimeters high, and about they can be anywhere from like 10 meters to 30 meters long. I don't have to convert it. So what our research is showing is that these features would have been the most common earthwork in North America. There would have just been, you know, they would be everywhere in Eastern North America. But the second that a plow goes over them, the second that, you know, you're building a house, the second you're driving a lot over them, you know, because they're only, you know, 30 centimeters high at most. Also, like a big storm can knock them out. You know, anytime you have any of these activities, they disappear. You know, they're gone. Yeah. And once they're gone, you know, like anything archaeological, it's gone forever. So these are particularly prone to destruction because of plowing, because where you put the ridges would be in places that are good for farming. Where you put a modern agricultural field today is places that are good for farming. And actually, if the Black Hawk War was fought in the early 1800s, was fought because Black Hawk and the tribe was told by an Indian agent that they could leave their cornfields for the winter to disperse, and that when they returned, they would be there. And a bunch of Euro-Americans came in over winter and took that farmland and put up fences and things. And so we know historically that this precedent happens. And then, of course, once you use Euro-American techniques, mainly plowing, then these ridges are gone.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this great image in the article that shows the LIDAR imagery. So like the which we'll talk about LIDAR here in a moment for the listener that I think we have covered this before, but we'll go into a little bit more detail. But then the inset photo sort of shows this side angle view of what the rows look like in an actual photograph. And there's a tree that's fallen over, and the tree is actually in higher relief than a number of the plowed fields. So if you're not kind of dialed in to look what you're looking at, it probably also would just get missed for a hummock in the woods too.
Yes. And we were actually just out there. So the year we took that photo, so I've been to a number of these sites and I take photos of them always. And I try to show people, then I'll give a presentation. I'm like, this is the ridge field. And they'll be like, what? I don't see anything. They can be really hard to see on the ground. And the year that we were there, the light was perfect. So we took the 100 photos. This year, we were at the same place, and we could not even see the ridges in that photo.
Interesting.
So we knew exactly where that photo was taken. We knew the angle that it was taken at, and we couldn't, you know, get anything remotely like it. So they're very difficult to see on the ground, even if you know they're there and you're trained to notice them. So, and that's because the vegetation grows up is the main reason. So the best time to locate them is actually in either early spring after the snow's melted, which is when we did the LIDAR, or in winter. If there's like a light snowfall, it can kind of fill in, you know, kind of create that topographic map for you.
Great. So we're going to talk a little bit about the methods too, but why do people make these raised garden beds? I guess just it's sort of by way of maybe just explaining the more traditional archaeobotanical methods that people are taking to approach this. How do you know what people were growing in these beds and that they really were farmers' beds?
Okay, so I'll start with the second question. How do we know these are garden beds? They're very well documented historically. So even in the 1800s, you have early kind of advocational archaeologists lamenting the fact that these ridges are getting destroyed by farmers. And they are noting that these are garden beds. So we know historically, there's early images of them, pictures of them. We've also used, we being archaeologists, use microbotanical techniques. So looking at particularly phytoliths. Phytoliths are small little silica bodies that plants create. And so they last for, I think, millions of years, but definitely in any archaeological timeline. And certainly, I mean, these ridges are typically, this type of agriculture is adopted around AD 1000. So plenty of time for these little silica bodies to preserve, right? Because there's nothing organic really to decompose there. And so what we have are the beds. And then if you look at the soil, we're finding phytoliths of corn, of squash. So if we're finding corn and squash, that means beans are just around the corner, right? Because that's the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash. And then there's other plants that show up at 60 Islands. There's evidence of sunflower and melons. So there's probably, you know, many other plants being grown also just based on preference. If you think about, you know, your neighbor's garden or any farm you've ever visited, you're going to have the kind of standard suite of crops. You know, today, I think, you know, if you look around the town I live in, it's going to be like everyone has tomatoes growing, right? But then But then everyone has something else unique, right? There's always one thing that someone's growing that's a little bit
different. You can just say marijuana, Maddie. It's fine. it's Canadian listen.
It's legal. I want to be clear that no one is growing marijuana on these beds. It is not that kind of agriculture. They might be growing tobacco. There might be tobacco. There might be other hallucinogenic plants, you know, but not marijuana.
Okay.
When it comes to phytolists, what is the technique for, I guess, identifying these, but also is it, so when you're thinking about things that you're not seeing, do you need to look specifically for tobacco to try to find it? Or is it something that like when you are analyzing these phytoliths, you can see something and be like, oh, what's this? And then go try to like, or are you specifically going in to look for corn or for maize and squash and beans and that sort of thing? Or is it that you're seeing everything and that those results are coming
out? So there's two ways to do it, right? So most plants don't create a species specific phytolith. So corn or maize is unique in that, is one of the plants that is unique in that. Most plants create a type of phytolith that then you can tell some characteristics about the ecosystem, let's say. So, but some plants, so I don't know if tobacco would be a unique phytolith, but to your question, does it need to have... Do you see everything? The answer is yes, you would see all the phytoliths. And so what you can do is you can get to a certain count. So what you'll do is you'll put it on a slide and you'll be looking at all the phytoliths and you'll see like, oh, a bunch of plants that like wet environments, let's say. And then one or two corn phytoliths. But what you could, or squash phytoliths, which also have a unique phytolith. But what you can do then is scan the slide if you were looking for something particular, right? So like you've gotten a general sense of the phytolith composition of the soil, and then you want to go back and see if there's something particular you were looking for. Which they, if you're looking for a cultigen, that's what you would do. In the case of why they are building these beds... Which is
going to seems like a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. If you just look at that one picture and think, okay, just if you're like, mom told you go out and make that, you'd be like, so much work. And now think about that. That's just one tiny little piece of that landscape. Thing, and this will tie back into phytoliths. Why are they making them? Primarily, they are making them. It seems that they slightly extend the growing season, so they control temperature better, which when you're that far north, that's going to be important. That said, they are also found in Georgia, where there isn't the same kinds of pressures. They do help control soil moisture, which is going to be important in both of those locations. The other thing that I think is going on that hasn't gotten as much attention in the literature, fortunately, you know, this is now my niche specialty, as Gabe mentioned. One thing that I think is good, the reason they're ridged or raised is that it's allowing them to make the soil. So what we're seeing is that there's a lot of compost, and there's also the inclusion of wetland soils, and we know that because of the phytoliths that are included. When we do those analyses, we are seeing lots of wet plants that aren't growing on site, which wouldn't grow in that particular location. We also see other wetland indicators like sponge spicules. And what that's telling us is that they're taking soil from the wetlands, bringing it onto the terraces, and these are natural landforms. It's not terraced agriculture. These kind of natural platforms, raised areas. And so why raised is that you can mix things that you want to mix in, compost, and that's probably for fertility, right? To make the soil more fertile.
Very cool. So and what you're describing is like a really, so like Gabe said, this is, it seems like a lot of work, but it also seems like
just building them would be a lot of work. If you were just going to mound the earth, that would be a tremendous amount of work. But then thinking about this, like each individual ridge has a recipe that, that has to be made with no beast of burden, right? So this is all.
Yeah. So that was. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to ask, is sort of like there's a whole bunch of different technologies that are probably being used here. So there's like vessel technology to carry probably from the wetland up to the ridges. There's probably some kind of like, you know, gardening hose, which are presumably either stone tools or, you know, on the plains here, they use like bison scapula. But are you seeing, do you see the remains of the tools that are kind of being, are sort of part of the farming gear that would be required to build these farmsteads?
No, but elsewhere, you know, this is not a unique technology. The ridges are not a unique technology. And so the tools used to build them are really varied based on, you know, where you would be in Eastern North America. So at 60 Islands, I don't know if they have bison scapula hose. We have them at Middle Grant Creek. We find those. So that would be, you know, definitely something that would be available in Wisconsin, the UP at that time. The other thing that we suspect is that they are trading some of this corn, potentially. And it could be that some of the things they're trading it for are different, you know, materials to make tools out of. But we don't have any agricultural tools at this time. We haven't located the village where these folks lived. So stay tuned. But I imagine the tools would be in the village.
Yeah. Listener can't see this, but as he was talking about bison hose, Ken was rolling up his sleeve to show off his newest tattoo, which maybe we'll throw that on the Instagram on the Instagram later. Yeah. But so, and I want to say too, one of the things this actually reminded me about when I was reading your paper, Maddie, was that great book, I think 1491 it was called, and it talks about these like anthropogenic soils in South America.
Yeah,
you know, being much more ubiquitous than we thought. And I was like, oh, it turns out. I mean, this is, I guess, the point of your paper. This is much more way more ubiquitous than we thought. It's even on the Upper Peninsula where it's not supposed to be. But before we kind of get to that.
About the South American link, after the paper came out, so Thomas Riley, he was a professor at Illinois and then later North Dakota State. And he called me up. Like, I just get this phone call from North Dakota, and I answered it because I used to, for a long time, I dated a guy from North Dakota back when in my, like, 20s. I thought maybe it was one of his family members or something who had seen the coverage. So I was like, oh, it must be, like, one of his sisters or something. So I answered this phone call from North Dakota, and then it's Thomas Riley who studied these features in...
And to be clear, it's not related to the person you used to date.
Well, not that I know of. We didn't really get into it. I mean, this is just exclusive content for your podcast. He was like, oh, Thomas, I'm expecting it to be like first a woman because the guy had a lot of sisters. And then it was, he was called me. He'd worked on these ridges in the 80s in the Midwest. And I cite his work a lot. So I was excited to talk to him. But his student was actually Clark Erickson. And Clark Erickson is the person who is one of the premier archaeologists who study those Amazonian raised beds.
Oh, cool.
And in the Andes as well. Wow. So, yeah, neat. It's a small world.
Okay, that is very cool. The raised bed conferences at a very few.
Yeah, there's like the cross-cultural connections here. So we've stitched it together. So I think we can add a new, we got to remember to add a new keyword in our on this podcast, Andean, as well as the, you know,
Yeah, you'll get a lot of tricks if you bring up this discussion of Andean archaeology. I also think perhaps you should start like 5 degrees from Kevin Bacon kind of thing, like 5 degrees from Andean archaeology or.
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was going to be 5 degrees from this ex-boyfriend in South Dakota. It turns out he actually is connected very well.
North Dakota. South Dakota. Are you crazy?
Oh, sorry. North Dakota. And so when you're finding these raised fields, one of the things that you did to identify the ubiquity was you used LIDAR. And our listeners know a little bit about LIDAR, but could you tell us, for ones who are just tuning in, about how it works and what the fields look like, both in the LIDAR and then in the subsequent ground truth thing?
Well, first, let me welcome your new listeners to the podcast. thanks for coming on to hear my thing. So what LIDAR is...
We should have Maddie do the intro and do the welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast.
Yeah, she's a 100%er, so that's, you know, we gotta...
So LIDAR. What LIDAR is... It is a technique where you basically send lasers from the air down to the earth. It can penetrate the tree canopy to a certain extent. We can talk about that. And then it hits the earth and it comes back. And what that does is basically just creates a topographic map of the surface of the earth. It has typically been flown from airplanes, and airplanes have to be flown fairly high for a whole range of safety reasons for folks on the ground and folks in the air. What we did, and what is increasingly being used in archaeology, is use drone-acquired LIDAR. So we used a drone to carry the equipment. That is a smaller piece of equipment than what can be flown from an airplane. But the benefits is you can fly a drone a lot lower than you can fly an airplane. So that gives you that increased resolution and allows you to see things that have lower relief, notably these 30 centimeter most high beds, which are not captured in most instances, on the kind of publicly available LIDAR. So drone LIDAR has, you know, anywhere from a 5 to 10 centimeter resolution, and sometimes even better. Plain publicly available LIDAR, I'm sure the military has, like, you have, like, LIDAR from space that's at, like, 1 centimeter, but archaeologists don't have access to that.
And you're not doing farming fields in Russia anyway. So
yeah, right? The publicly available LIDAR is about 50 centimeter resolution. So anything less than 50 centimeters, you're not really going to see. Now, the other piece of this, as I mentioned, it can penetrate the tree canopy. But when you're looking for features as subtle as these ridges are, the LIDAR is going to hit the leaves, right? Those lasers are going to hit the leaves, and then they're going to shoot back up. So you want to maximize the kind of penetration to the ground. And the Upper Peninsula has a lot of trees. So we went in springtime, this really kind of critical window that's only a couple weeks long, where the snow's melted, right? Because if it's covered in snow, you're not going to see them. And the trees don't have leaves. So it's this really tight window. And that made, you know, really nice resolution. You can't do it in fall, because in fall, all the leaves are still so fresh and fluffy that, you know, they kind of build little leaf piles on the ground. So it has to be spring, and that is what LIDAR is. That's how we did it.
Nice. And so something that's kind of interesting about this
is that, and you mentioned, so you haven't found the village that goes with these fields yet. And I think what's kind of, I think for the listener be interested in, what does what do these findings tell us a little bit about small scale societies, groups that are probably hunting and gathering groups, hunting, fishing and gathering groups, rather than sort of settled village horticulturalists? Or are you thinking that there's probably a combination of both as it relates to who's building and maintaining these fields and what it means about, like, you know, we talked about the invested effort in building these fields. There's also probably a maintenance aspect to it. And so living close to these places is probably important. And we'd expect to see people close by. But what are you guys finding? What are you thinking about that?
So typically what we know of ancestral Menominee communities is that they practice semi-sedentary lifestyle, meaning in the summer or the warm weather months, so spring through harvest, they are kind of pooling their labor and living together. And then come winter, they break up into smaller groups for hunting. So, you know, I think there isn't a... And during harvest, too, we see, you know, people continue to collect plants. Even though these are very extensive agricultural fields, no one was going hungry. But people continue to collect plants for other reasons. They might like the different kinds of wild plants, you know, different fruits and things that are available. Something like the pawpaw, right? We see pawpaw show up, which is kind of a tropical banana-like Midwest plant. I don't know that they have that in Wisconsin or at 60 Islands. I'm just naming. We have it at Middle Grant Creek.
You heard it here first, listener.
Yeah, it might be a little too...
Between that and the marijuana.
Yeah, it might be a little too far north. 60 Islands might be a little too north for pawpaw. But that would just be an example of a plant that's foraged elsewhere. And then the other thing that people are always... the ancestral Native American communities are continue to gather our medicinal plants. So those would be other sources of that would kind of continue that plant collection. Now, and that just has to do with where those plants are grown, as well as some of the kind of properties of and ritual and ideas about medicinal plants. So there aren't these kind of tight... I think one thing you see is that so much of archaeological theory is dominated by a handful of models that really come out of, you know, the Middle East and Europe. And what we see is elsewhere, lots of diversity in the kinds of trajectories and the ways that people take up farming, and the ways that they intensify farming. So this is, I would say, kind of textbook definition of intensive agriculture. And yet we don't see the kind of normative ways that archaeologists envision intensive agriculture being adopted, notably like the rise of inequality.
Yeah. So this isn't Neolithic revolution at 1000 CE kind of thing. It's
not that. We also don't see, or we don't think that there's any food pressure. Wild rice is pretty abundant up there. Now, it could have gone through like several years of, you know, not being abundant. However, these fields are in cultivation for 600 years. So it was not likely that wild rice had a 600-year bad run. So there is this alternative staple food. There's no kind of tribute demands. There's also real questions around how labor was organized here, because there's nobody standing there saying, you have to go build these fields, right? And we're going to build them there, and we're going to have it stretch up to here, right? And so there's lots of interesting questions about power that are coming out of this paper, because it is so intensive, and the community is a relatively small-scale community. Now, it is also very likely that the ancestral Menominee community living here is much larger than we currently thought, but not large like Mesopotamia large, right? Or even Cahokia large, or the other Mississippian centers like Aztalan up in Wisconsin. It is not that. And yet the scale of agriculture, this is the largest known ancestral Native American agricultural site. And it is where we would least expect it. So the ones at Cahokia would have been vastly larger. The ones in Aztlan would be vastly larger. So we've grossly underestimated the scale of ancestral Native American farming based on this kind of outlying example.
Yeah, and that ties into what Gabe was talking about with these land use patterns, right? Like, you guys make a point in the paper of talking about just sort of the scale of the land clearing that's going on, probably to accommodate these kinds of agricultural fields. And this is kind of one of the themes of 1491 that Gabe was talking about, that like the sort of changes to the landscape, the way that like indigenous people were shaping the landscape for their purposes was at a scale that I think we've kind of underestimated all the time, basically.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's the forest today is all as a secondary forest, but it was typically thought to be cleared by Euro-American loggers. There would have, however, been another prior clearing to build the 60 Islands landscape farm. So the 60 Island farm would have had to be cleared. And that is a tremendous undertaking based on the current tree cover. And we don't know how quickly that unfolded. You know, we don't know if it was just, you know, 2 years of logging or something to build this field. Or, you know, one thing we don't have a strong sense of is how long these ridges, these individual ridges, were in use. So is the farming taking place in kind of forest hollows where you're just clearing the area you need to clear? And then as those become less productive, you know, clearing a new area, building a new set, or are they all in use at once? But what we do know is that the kind of iconic forests of the UP were not there at, you know, from about 1000 CE to, or AD 1000 to 1600. Not the way that they are.
And so,
yeah.
And so just to kind of emphasize this, because I think we've come at this a little bit obliquely, one of the fields you're looking at, because they're in this marginal environment, are really well preserved. And so, what this seems to really suggest is that indigenous agriculture was just much more ubiquitous throughout North America than, so between this and Cahokia, that kind of bookends a lot of room for a lot of indigenous agriculture around North America, of which you had rare access to be able to see it using these techniques in a pretty well-preserved landscape.
Yeah, and I think that we'll find more examples. So there's a few ways to kind of turn back the clock, right, to locate these fields. So This is just one example of the kinds of landscape modifications that are unfolding prior to European contact, right? So you have all the mound building, and you have effigy mounds in kind of Wisconsin and then kind of periphery around Wisconsin. So you have
sports fields to foreshadow what we'll talk about later.
right, so you have all of these, you have a tremendous amount of reworking of the topography particularly of the eastern U.S., which has unfortunately been erased. But you also would have, like, storage pits would have left a topographic expression. So there is just a tremendous amount, and what you had a question, Gabe, in there. About it.
I was kind of opining that I think one of the interesting things is just that
oh, I remember.
If people
I was gonna
are
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are so one thing, this form of agriculture is very widespread throughout Eastern North America, right? There's expressions in Georgia, expressions in the UP. There's raised beds in Cape Cod, right? So there are these various remnants, and some of them are buried. They're at Angel Mounds. They have this is Ed Herman's work, along with some other folks. So there are these kind of glimpses of them in various locations. And what we haven't known, and what we still don't really know, is with these kind of glimpses that we get of them, these small remnants, is how big what does that remnant represent? Does that remnant represent 1%, 2%, 80%? Right? And we've never known that. And we get some sense of that through the historical documents, but that wasn't... the descriptions in historical records are like miles and miles of cornfields. Cornfields as far as the eye can see. Which, like,
if you're my height, cornfields as far as the eye can see, it's actually not very far. you just see into the corn, in my experience.
Yeah, so they've never been especially specific. And so that makes it hard for us as archaeologists to know, does this represent 1%? And I think what this data shows is that we know that pieces of the 60 island landscape, just based on the abruptness with which the fields disappear, depending on who's the landowner of the particular property. We know that that's a remnant, and yet that's so huge. So it kind of goes to reason that, yes, we would, if we have these remnants in Cape Cod, and we have them in Indiana, and we have them in Georgia, and we have them in the UP, and we have them in Wisconsin, then this is a very extensive and popular way to grow plants.
Right.
That's great. Can you tell us a little bit about your... Oh, sorry, Ken.
Oh, you might have been going to the next question I was going to, so yeah.
Take it away.
So you mentioned that the project's been done in collaboration with the Menominee, and you had mentioned that apart from them kind of pointing out where they thought you should go and do some work specifically to find what you guys found, what are some of the collaborative aspects of the project and the parts of the project that they've been excited about and perhaps encouraged your research team to pursue?
Well, you know, I'm not collaborating with the Menominee. I'm collaborating with that'd be a lot of collaborators. It'd be a long list on the authorship form. But so, you know, like any other, you know, group, I'm sure they have wide ranging opinions. So I'll just speak to Dave Greeno, is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, and he's been on the, you know, he's an author on the paper. He has been, you know, really spearheaded this effort and advocated for it. Another person who I would love to mention is Jeff Greeno, who passed away a year ago, maybe a little more, but he is my friend, and he and I did a lot of work on these at the reservation together. And I am sad that he's not around to see this, because he would have loved this. I guess the best answer would just be my experience. And then a graduate student at University of Wisconsin, Menominee grad student, is worked with us this summer.
That's great. Just while you're looking at that, I guess we should say that you've had kind of a long-standing series of research projects in this region.
Yeah, so I've been working with the Menominee, various individuals at the Menominee reservation since 2020. And then this, and particularly I've been working with Dave Greeno the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, and Dr. Dave Overstreet, who is not himself Menominee, but is, he's passed away, but he was a archaeologist for the Menominee.
Great. And so you were going to say, the student from Wisconsin is working with you now, Watsa?
Excellent. Watsa, whose name is Miranda Washinawatuk.
Okay, excellent. Great. And I guess the other thing we wanted to follow up on before we turn to gaming was so this paper has gotten a unique amount of attention in the press, to say the least. So I am not accustomed to opening up NPR and seeing my friends in it, or the New York Times. That's very exciting. And I suspect you're not particularly accustomed to getting calls from the New York Times and the journalists at Science, but could you just tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yes. It's been a real mixed bag, you know. And
tell us what it was like when you got the call from Ken.
You know, when I got the call from Ken, or the email, such as it was, you know, it was like, most dreams, you know, don't get realized. They just stay dreams. But then every once in a while, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, what? That is how I felt with the New York Times. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be in the New York Times. And then I was like, oh, by the way, my kid is sick. So Casey, my son, also got to be part of the New York Times interview. And the reporter was really nice because he sent me a follow-up email and he just said, some of the audio got a little garbled and I just want to make sure that I got this right. And what he meant by the audio getting garbled was that there was a screaming baby. but anyway, no, the media stuff has been a real mixed bag. For the most part, there's wonderful things about it. I'm so happy for archaeology that people are seeing the value of this project and these landscapes, that it's getting the attention that is long overdue for the efforts of past ancestral Native American communities who worked, you know, whose impacts are still kind of just always overshadowed by the pristine myth, even though I don't know how many times archaeologists have to tell people it didn't exist. Then there is the way that the narrative's been framed in some of the, you know, the different, not all of them, but some of them. And one thing that's been frustrating is that we're real newcomers to this project. That this site was documented in the 90s by Marla Buckmaster and Jan Brashler, who did tremendous work there. Dave Overstreet was a huge, I mean, he spent his career documenting these kinds of sites and working with the Menominee, and was the force behind getting us to, you know, this wasn't on my radar. This was Dave Overstreet and Dave Greenough who knew about this site and pushed for us to go up there. And so we're really just, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants and getting a lot of credit for discovering. And that my friends,
you're hovering a drone over their shoulders. It's
yeah. So, you know, we're getting this credit for discovering the site. The site, we did not discover the site. We discovered cool things about the site. But it's really a credit to the kinds of folks that have done the huge amount of work to enable this project, both, you know, on the groundwork, like Marla's map. I don't know what she was using to get people to map so well, but her map, her hand-drawn map is like as good as the LiDAR. I mean, it lines up perfectly with the LiDAR. It is the best map, wow, I think, ever in archaeology. So I don't know, she was like, how she got students to map that way, but like magic combined with excellent training. And then of course Dr. Overstreet and Dave Greenough, who really impressed on us how important this was. And it's also a credit to the Menominee, because the Menominee tribe has invested a tremendous amount of time and effort and money fighting this mine that is coming in. And were they not to do that, I don't know that the site would even still be there. So, and then also to Tom Borner, who is the landowner who owns most of 60 Islands, who is such a wonderful steward for this archaeology, lets us do, you know, use his hose, fly a drone using his internet connection. I mean, lets us stay at his house. I mean, the man is so wonderful and kind. And all of that has gotten lost in this kind of Dartmouth archaeologists and their drone come in and discover this new site. And it's like, no, that is not what happened. And so it's frustrating. And I hope my colleagues who are co-authors on the paper, you know, Dave Greeno and Dave Overstreet in particular, you know, they, and as well as, you know, people like Buckmaster, you know, recognize that it's the press, you know, wanting this kind of discovery narrative and not what I say, which is normally long-winded and
and yeah. Well, and it's interesting too that you say that, because it's in the light of, like, there was a recent article in Science Advances about sort of the U.S. media coverage of archaeology and the ways it gets regionalized and in different parts of the world, and you know, and I think that we all sort of struggle with this. There's pieces of our research that get pulled out, and I mean, I don't get any media attention for my research, really. But what we see, for example, getting picked
we
up.
We are the media, Ken.
Yeah, exactly. But what we see getting picked up are, you know, these easy bylines, and it can be hard to characterize what we think is actually the important part of the research with what, you know, what headline is going to grab.
Right. Yeah.
That's important.
I think that overall, I've been happy with the way that the research has been like contextualized. But it is just the way that it's in kind of the broader arc of archaeology. I think that's, you know, which was what I was worried about, like you were saying, Ken, but it's the way that it's been framed as, like, you know, that I'm this hero. And this is not just me being modest, because I'm not. the way that I'm cast as this, like, you know, hero, the protagonist, where, you know, it's tremendously a group effort. Even Jesse Cassana, who is my colleague who did the LIDAR work, you know, all of the LIDAR work. He flew the drone. He did the processing along with Carolyn Ferwerda. He interpreted the results and things like this. He was quoted. He was cited in the New York Times as guy who flew the drone. Jesse's like, I am not guy who flew the drone.
I don't know. I would clip that out and put it right on my door. Like, let the dean know every time he walked by.
Yeah, yeah. So I do
want to take this opportunity to thank Dave Overstreet and Marla Buckmaster in particular, and Dave Greeno. Because, like I said, it's their work, and Jan Brashler, because it's their work that made all this happen. And Tom, yeah. Oh my gosh, Tom. Yeah, because without them, you know, none of, like I said, we're newcomers to this. So, and that's been lost in the media coverage. That's but you great. Can feel free and, to and edit this thing, out to be, you know. Yeah.
Emmanuel, every time she mentioned a name, you could bleep it out. But one thing I wanted to say too, just before we move on to gaming here, Ken and I were talking about this paper last night, and it's the kind of paper that, like, I felt like when I read it, and Ken was saying you felt the same way, you sort of read it and you're like, oh, this is absolutely a science paper. Like, the implications are really, really clear as you're reading it. But the other thing I would say, if you're one of our listeners and you're thinking, oh, I'm not a specialist archaeologist, I don't think I'd understand it, I would say you actually would probably understand it. It's yeah, very clearly yes. written, and the implications are pretty obvious. So I'd really encourage you, in addition to chasing out the media stories about it, just read the paper. It's a really, really good paper. Yeah. So,
and it's open access.
It is not open access, but I have Yeah, I have a link on my website that you could download the paper, or you can just email me directly.
Okay, so it must have been, you know what it I must be do? Showing up as open.
I can give you
because I'm on campus.
I can give you the open access link.
Oh,
well, I can give you the author link to put in your show notes.
Oh, fantastic! Thank you so much, Maddie. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and you all should be very proud of this, and congratulations to you and the other authors. It's a really great paper. But to change gears here for a minute, just for a couple of minutes, this other project you do that I've been fascinated about, mm-hmm. You teach a course at Dartmouth on Indigenous gaming.
Yep.
I'm fascinated by
sports
that.
Sports and games.
Sports and games. Could you tell us a little bit about that course and what you do in it? Ken will copy down this furiously to try to recreate your syllabus while you're...
I can make it easy for you. Just send it to you. Yeah. So I was teaching a class on... Basically, I teach a class called Ancient Native Americans at Dartmouth, which is basically just intro to North American archaeology. And in that class, I always... Mostly, we kind of go through time. Where, you know, we start with how did the continent get peopled and then, you know, move through kind of the big civilizations. And but I always do like a little bit on games in that class. And we go to the Hood Museum, which is our on-campus museum, and they have a handful of gaming implements. And I always enjoyed it the most, and my students tended to like it. And so each time I would teach a little bit more. Alongside this, Jeff Greeno, who I mentioned, he and I were talking a lot about lacrosse because there's a Ridgefield site right next to a historic lacrosse field. So the Ridgefield site predates the where they played lacrosse on the reservation. And so we had been talking about lacrosse, and then I got this job as an assistant professor, and I decided I, you know, wanted to teach a class on games. I started doing some research on lacrosse at the reservation. So I'm enjoying and looking forward to developing that project more. So what we do in the games class is we just go through North American games and their significance and the ways that sports and games are deeply intertwined with other kinds of social phenomena. In particular, like inequality, enslavement is a big theme that comes up a lot in the gaming literature. People gamble. People have gambling problems. That seems to be a human trait. So, and they had them in the past too. And we also play them. So we play Chunky. Oh, cool. We play Waltis, thanks to Gabe's.
Maddie, every game I've ever played, I play Chunky. That's really the only.
So yeah, Chunky, for those not familiar, is not just Gabe's winter physique, but it is a game that involves rolling. It's a version of what's called a hoop and pull game, which are really common across North America. And basically, it's rolling the hoop and pull. As you roll the hoop, and you try and pierce it with the pull. In Chunky, you kind of have like a spear, and you throw it at, rather than a hoop, a stone disc. And someone rolls the disc, and then two people throw the spear, and the person who is closest to the stone disc gets the point. And you have to throw it while it's rolling to make it hard. And this game became wildly popular in Cahokia. It's really fun to play, actually. And then the other game I would say that's really common that we see a lot of different varieties of across North America is various versions of a dice game. And DeBoer has a really great article on this of dice and women, if you're interested. Of the kind of range, how common this game is across North America. And so we, so, and Waltis is a, the Mi'kmaq version of that, and of the dice game. And typically, you know, you think of dice as, you know, if you're a Monopoly player, like a 6-sided die, or if you're a D&D player, like a 20-sided die. This is not either one of those. It's a, they're more like little discs that have two different faces, and then they're flipped in typically in a basket, and there's typically six. But like anything else, variety is a common theme. And then depending on how many are face up, face down for each throw of them, you get different sets of points. So that's a really cool game. We play that. And yeah. But yeah, so the it's just based around kind of these different entanglements of games and how they're so deeply entrenched. The reason I started teaching, why I wanted to teach the class is often, and I think this is especially true in North American archaeology, but it is true across archaeology, is that we forget that people in the past are people. We often reduce them to just like food, and some of that's just because that's what we have left, but they're just like going out, getting food, spending their days. Like maybe they have some religion and ritual. We'll toss that in. But like past, yeah, like all the time.
After a hard day of making the ridged fields, what do they do?
Yeah. Like,
and they travel, they travel following arrows between rocks and resources,
we
kind of thing.
That they like fell in love. They hated people, you know, not like in a warfare way, just in like a, ugh, that person, can't stand them. You know, that they play games. And so I really wanted to bring that, that aspect back into archaeology for my students, that these, their lives were not so fundamentally different than theirs. Like they still like to have fun. And that is one critique I have of the gaming literature and the sports literature, is that it is so focused on these games aren't just fun. They are, you know, they're ways to control the hierarchy, you know, to keep it from getting out of control. There are ways to, you know, they're reflective of religion. They're, you know, or like, you know, their mourning rituals. They're, you know, any number of other things than just fun. And I always, that is my one critique, is that, but they are also fun. We can let people in the past have a good time. We don't have to justify it. I mean, they are just in the way sports today, right? If we think about sports, they're so, you know, they're so enmeshed in our economies and our identities, right? Like if someone is a Yankees fan, you have certain ideas about them, right? I mean,
a Rumble Ponies fan.
Yeah. I'm wearing my Toronto Maple Leafs.
Exactly, right?
Now,
their clothing, right? So, I mean, and that is very true today, and it was very true in the past, of course. And there's different times. Lacrosse was a healing ceremony. So it was played when individuals were sick to help heal them. So there's a lot of ways that sports are so deeply integrated in the past, but I do think it is, we don't have to, we can also remember that one reason that they are played is that they're fun and people like to have fun. So I really, the other thing I really, that's like on my list of things is every Valentine's Day, I think I should do a talk on love potions.
That's a great idea.
And it always gets away from me. But that is another one that I think, you know, would bring back some of the kind of human element to archaeology. Would be like how many love potions there are. My new lab mate, well, we have a new lab, and we're both moving into it this week. She's an archaeobotanist as well. And so maybe I can convince her to, it's like the right time to ask to do a love potions. Yeah. We have a lot of time to prep. But my favorite medicinal I won't remember what tribe. It's one of the federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. But there's a plant that you can process one way to make someone fall in love with you, and you can process it another way to fall out of love. And that is, I think, just brilliant. It's like no one ever thinks about falling out, but there's real reasons you would want to fall out of love, right? Like,
yeah, no, it's true.
And I'm just like, how this is so wonderful and not part of the current discourse.
You know, yeah. Like, you could see our many lacrosse bro listeners had picked up their pens. They thought you were going to describe a performance-enhancing drug.
There are those as well. Yeah. That was actually one of the things that is close, like one of the ties. So I do a little bit of work with medicinal plants, obviously love potions. But the way we can tie those pieces together is there are a tremendous amount of ritual around, as there is today, right? Ritual around lacrosse in particular, or any game probably, but in lacrosse, the one I know of, you know, there's things you would put on your stick. There are different prohibitions you would have before a game. And so there's, you know, one way I think you could identify a lacrosse area would be through the kind of heightened number of medicinal plants in the archaeobotany surrounding it.
Very cool. Because, the trainer's room.
Yeah. Sports medicine, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But then, of course, then people do get injured. Like in the Appalachian ball game, I think it's the Appalachian ball game. It's like a small ball. It's like the size of like a ping pong ball. Players would put it in their mouths and then people would just like beat them until they spit it out.
Oh, wow.
This is a different, it's like hockey, I guess.
Did you mention that during the ad drop period for your course, or was that a surprise? Well, Maddie, we really appreciate you coming up with this conversation. It was really exciting to talk about this paper, and it's a great paper, so congratulations. And I'm hopeful that as your research progresses in love potions and in sports, that we can get you back on to talk about those topics in more depth.
Yeah. I think that we should get you on for a Valentine's Day podcast, and you can share with our listeners the most recent recipe for love potions.
Yeah, maybe I'll come on as just like a quick little like, and here's five love potions for those who are looking for love this Valentine's Day.
We could do it as a sponsor in the middle of the show. We'll have you come on, you know, because everyone's heard of love potion number 9, but if you come on and describe 1 through 8, we'll be in much better shape.
I do. I mean, you are laughing, but there are things that make the world move, and it's love and sports. Those are two really cool
ones. There we go.
This
next Valentine's Day, listeners, stay tuned for
love and sports with Maddie McLeister.
Thanks so much, Maddie. Yep.
Thanks for having me. We'll be right back.